Hey there. Welcome to the latest episode of In the Money. I'm Jim Armstrong with Fidelity. Thank you for making time to be with us today. Thrilled, as always, to be joined by Tony Zhang. Certainly, a lot of you know him as co-founder and chief strategist over at Options Play. You probably also know him as a regular contributor here on In the Money. Tony, great to see you.
Good to see you as well, Jim. Good. It's been an interesting week. Looking forward to breaking it down.
I was going to say, it is. I'm anxious to get your sense of what's happening in the macro environment. It is worth saying out loud, it is Thursday, April the 16th, as we have this conversation. And at the risk, Tony, of making what feels like an absolutely gigantic understatement, I don't think the markets are, I don't think we collectively are, where people might have predicted where we would be in mid-April, given everything that's happening in the world, particularly in the Middle East. So help us get our bearings.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I was going to say, even last week, if you asked me if we would be at all-time highs, I would have said there's a fairly low chance of that happening. But yet, here we are a week later, the S&P is breaking out above 7,000. We're at all-time highs again. 11 consecutive winning sessions on the NASDAQ 100. You know, 2 weeks ago, we were at seven-month lows. The VIX was above 30%, and we have to seemingly flip to a completely different regime. At the moment, it seems like the markets have completely looked past what's happened in the Middle East and now focused on earnings season, and which actually has been so far been a pretty strong earnings season. But before we kind of break into some of those details, one of the things that I think that's been driving, part of it's been driving the optimism that we've seen here, obviously with the peace talks in the Middle East is a big driving factor of this, but also inflation numbers coming in, the PPI numbers coming in far lower than expected. The headline number of 0.5% versus the 1.1% that was the consensus, and the core essentially coming in flat. Services inflation was flat, and what this really shows us is that the oil shock has so far not bled into broader higher prices across the board, across food and other areas of inflation. And I think that has been a major positive shift in the markets and away from the concerns that we have, from the stagflationary concerns that we had even just a couple of weeks ago.
And that, Tony, is fascinating in all by itself. But you mentioned inflation, which makes me think, at least, of the Federal Reserve and their next FOMC meeting coming up at the end of this month, at the end of April. I wanted to get your sense of what you think that might bring, but also ask you to talk about that through the lens of a viewer question that came in by Gregory when he registered for In the Money this week. He's asking when or if we think the Fed could begin raising interest rates, given all that's happening. So an interesting question, because it feels like we've been talking so much about lowering rates. Gregory is asking for the opposite, or about the opposite.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And if you asked me that 3 weeks ago, we started to see a fairly increased probability of potentially a rate increase rather than a rate cut as a result of the concerns around the stagflationary environment, especially if oil was in the 120, especially if it started approaching $150 a barrel. We do have a situation where it could lead to runaway inflation and require the Fed to raise interest rates. At the moment, if you look at that March PPI number that just came out, we'll continue to see more inflation numbers come out over the next couple of weeks. So far, it seems to show that inflation has not bled into broader prices. So for the moment, I actually think the Fed still has the door open for potentially a rate cut here in late 2026 if things continue down this path, especially if peace in the Middle East, things do not escalate further in the Middle East. I think we do have to remember that the Strait of Hormuz still remains closed and 20% of the world's global oil supply is still trapped. And that is a major concern that I have here down the line, even though in the short run, we might be moving past that. But if you look at kind of where the markets are pricing in right now, they're not pricing in any rate cuts until September of 2027, based on current market prices. So I don't necessarily think rate increases are in the cards, but at the same time, rate cuts are not in the cards either. You know, like I said, a lot of this has been driven by geopolitics, the seemingly interest for both U.S. and Iran to continue peace talks is what's providing the optimism. But again, I remind investors that 20% of the world's oil supply is still trapped right now in the Strait of Hormuz. And there isn't a clear path as to how that is going to be resolved at the moment. And I think that's going to be the biggest driver of potential sentiment with regards to how oil prices react, because we've seen WTI and Brent get back below $90, which is a sign of a lot of optimism. But we've also seen pullbacks here in the past become opportunities to take long exposure here in oil, because like I said, that situation in the Middle East with regards to oil has not been resolved. And that path to resolution, from my perspective, is not particularly clear at the moment.
You mentioned earnings season just a minute ago, Tony. So I wanted to bring you back to that. And you also just mentioned this idea of optimism and customer sentiment. And when you talk about earnings season, I'm just interested in your perspective. There seems like there's this dichotomy between the way investors and consumers are reporting they feel about what's happening in the world and what companies are actually reporting they're seeing happen in the world.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We just saw consumer sentiment reach a record low. Yet if you look at earnings, we're looking at pretty solid reports across the board. If you look at the banks across the board, they beat earnings by a pretty solid amount, with the exception of maybe Goldman Sachs. If you look at technology, you look at TSM, they just reported strong guidance here today. ASML raised full year guidance as well on the back of strong AI demand. And just, you know, even though 5% of S&P 500s have reported so far, 80% of them have beat on earnings, 90% of them have beat on revenue. And the blended, you know, Q1 growth right now is coming in around 13% year-over-year growth. That's a sixth straight double-digit quarter growth that we've seen on the S&P 500. So corporate profitability is telling us a much different picture than what consumers are concerned about. And I think that's really kind of the optimism that we're seeing here in the markets right now, is this shift back towards the optimism that we saw before the Iran war. VIX is at 18%, which is kind of the market pricing out the worst case scenarios in Iran. And, you know, we did have some numbers come out a little weaker than expected of industrial production earlier today. But the question is really, are consumers cracking under, you know, gas above $4 a gallon? And so far, it seems like consumers are remaining fairly resilient. The banks gave us a little bit of visibility into how consumers and businesses are holding up. And so far, you know, from JP Morgan, from Bank of America, it seems that the consumer right now is actually holding up quite well, despite the fact that consumer sentiment is at kind of record lows.
All right. So you've set the foundation for the trades that you're going to talk about this week, albeit a slightly confusing and a foundation full of mixed signals. Nevertheless, lots of interest, Tony, from In the Money viewers about what exactly you would do for your trades this week. I have a couple of viewer questions that came in during registration I wanted to share just before you get going. Don wrote in to say he's, quote, curious to see what trades are chosen during the ceasefire. And a viewer named Gianluca is asking generally in terms of how we should think about option strategies during market conditions like these. So again, a lot of people looking to see how you frame and position your trades based on what's happening in the world around us.
Yeah, I think just overall, before we dive into our first trade idea, some of the things that you want to think about is there's definitely room to be optimistic right now, especially around technology, which has been a primary driver of growth, and that the growth that we continue to see in corporate growth is coming from technology. But at the same time, you want to be a little bit more defensive and also be concerned about downside, because like I said, 20% of the world's oil supply is trapped. Not only oil is trapped, but you also have fertilizer, aluminum, you know, other commodities that are critical to the global supply chain that are trapped right now. And that does not have a clear resolution. And I think there's some downside risks that remain. But with that said, what I want to take a look at first is heading into earnings season. So far, earnings season has been on a tear. And one name that's reporting this afternoon is Netflix. This is a trade that we actually looked at a few weeks ago that has been a successful trade. And I think heading into earnings for Netflix later today is worth taking a look at here again. And Netflix has really has really turned itself around from just simply being a streaming story into now what we would consider more of a diversified media powerhouse. If you look at kind of what they've done with regards to their ad revenue, there was a lot of doubts initially as to the execution of the ad revenue tier, but they've seen a pretty substantial growth out of that tranche of subscribers. They're reaching about 190 million ad tier viewers now, and they've doubled their revenue from $1.5 billion last year to be projected to be about $3 billion this year. And this afternoon's earnings announcement will give us a read into how successful or what trajectory that ad revenue is going to be on. And I think that's going to be a main driver of sentiment for this stock going forward. You also have live events that have been an interesting addition to Netflix away from just the traditional streaming content model. Live events is a much higher margin business for them. It's a premium destination for viewers and also international growth. They now have 325 million members across the world. And this is really what's driving subscription growth here is the international markets right now. And if you look at the stock here, the stock has obviously struggled a lot in the past couple of years, but just recently it broke out above that $100 resistance level, which largely capped the stock at the end of last year. Trends have turned bullish. It's outperformed the S&P 500, both short-term and long-term. It's actually outperformed the S&P 500 by nearly 17% over the last 3 months. So that $100 support, that resistance that it broke out from, is now targeting as support. And our upside target is actually around $135, the level that we saw right before the Iran war. And if you look at the business, it is trading at a premium valuation around 33 times forward earnings, which is, five turns higher than the industry. But if you look across the board, EPS and revenue growth, they are head and shoulders above the competition. And more importantly, net margins sitting at around 25% is nearly 2.5 times the industry average. So from a fundamental perspective, this company looks like it's firing on all cylinders. They've certainly rebranded themselves and they've reinvented themselves as a company. And the fundamentals, while looking a little bit expensive, reflects the growth and profitability that Netflix has relative to its peers.
Super interesting, Tony, to hear you sort of allow us the space to take a breath and examine something that most of us have probably been not aware we were watching from the sidelines. This evolution of Netflix from, as you described it, this very straightforward streaming service to this multi-revenue, high-margin media platform. So through that lens, Tony, I'm curious what trade you are proposing that could sort of take advantage of that bullish sentiment.
Yeah, so heading into earnings right now, options prices are quite elevated. If you look at implied volatility, we are certainly on the higher end of the 52-week range right now. So heading into earnings, considering the fact that the stock has run quite a bit here in the last month or so, my preference is to be a seller of options going into earnings. So I'm looking at going out to the May expiration. I'm looking at selling the 107-102 put spread, collecting a net credit of around $2 for that $5 wide credit spread. And what's interesting about this type of strategy is that I'm risking $300 to potentially make $200. But in a trade like this, one of three things can happen after you sell a put spread. The stock can go higher, it can move sideways, or it can move lower. And two out of the three possible scenarios, a structure like this will be profitable as long as the stock stays above roughly 105, this is a trade that will be profitable, heading into that May expiration. And again, I'm taking a short put strategy here because of the high implied volatility. I want to be short volatility here. And because the stock has ran so far, I think the upside, how much further the stock can run may be more limited. And that's why I'm taking more of a neutral to bullish view rather than an outright bullish view by buying, let's say, a call option heading into earnings.
Probably, Tony, will come as no surprise to you that a lot of In the Money viewers are very interested in getting inside your head a little bit and learning about how you make the choices you make. A lot of questions that came in from viewers this week had to do specifically with what you think, the factors you consider, and how you choose strike prices and expiration dates. I know you touched on that a little bit with this particular trade, but talk a little bit more about it, if you could, please.
Yeah, absolutely. Whenever you're selling a credit spread, the general rule of thumb is that I usually go out somewhere between 30 to 45 days as a starting point for an expiration date choice. So I'm using the May 15th because with an earnings catalyst coming up, I like to shorten up the timeline for it just simply because the catalyst is actually this afternoon. There's a very good chance that I may hold this trade just for a few days if the stock starts to run after earnings. I likely will be out of this trade fairly quickly, which is why I'm choosing the shorter expiration date here for this particular trade. And in terms of strike prices, I'm generally wanting to choose strike prices that are relatively close to the current price of the stock because from my perspective, heading into earnings, the most important thing for me is to have a balanced risk to reward. You can certainly sell out of the money credit spreads that have a very high probability of success, but the problem with those types of strategies is that you have very poor risk to reward. You could be risking upwards of 3, 4, 5 times the potential profit that you have on this particular trade versus when I'm selling a credit spread that's closer to the current price of the stock, I'm risking no more than $1.50 for every $1 I can potentially make, so that if let's say Netflix for some reason disappoints on the ad tier growth or let's say international growth, and we see that the stock trades back, you know, below $100 or so, I want to make sure that the risk that I'm taking is balanced compared to how much I can potentially make, and I do that by selecting strike prices that are closer to the current price when I'm selling a credit spread.
Excellent context. Thank you for that. Let's move on then to your second trade idea of the week, Tony. And I can make an easy prediction that this one is going to be a fan favorite, or at least generate a lot of interest, because we've gotten many questions over the past couple of weeks from viewers about AI and what you're thinking when it comes to opportunities in AI, artificial intelligence. I'm looking at questions from Ward, from Gustavo, from Venugopal, lots of people asking about AI. So what can you tell them today?
Yeah, so my second trade I want to take a look at is with regard to the AI infrastructure recovery. And this is something that we have had a strong thesis on, even heading before into the Iran war, and where it was very clear to us that compute demand currently cannot satisfy demand. And we actually just saw the Wall Street Journal article earlier this week confirmed that Anthropic is having a really tough time meeting customer demand in terms of their compute availability. And this all plays into the hands of the pick and shovel, if you will, of the AI infrastructure world, which is essentially the semiconductors. Now you have semiconductor the chip makers such as NVIDIA, AMD, Intel, those types of companies. But the one company that kind of sits at the forefront of all of this is ARM, because they are essentially the foundational architecture that all of these chips are built on. So they essentially earn a royalty on every single custom chip that are being built. If you look at Alphabet, you look at Microsoft, you look at Amazon, everyone is building their own custom chips for inference compute. And the expectation is that by 2029, 90% of AI servers will be on custom silicon for AI compute. And this is really where ARM earns a royalty on every single chip that is earned. So regardless of whether it's Alphabet or Microsoft or Amazon building these chips, and Meta's, almost everyone is getting into building their custom chips. We also just saw news that XAI is looking at building their own chips here as well. ARM is essentially the infrastructure that the architecture that all of these chips are built on, and they earn a royalty on every single one of them. Not to mention that ARM has just built their first silicon themselves, the first one they built in 35 years with Meta as a partner on this, that's expected to generate another $15 billion in revenue by 2031. So ARM is really an interesting play within kind of the AI infrastructure from a chips perspective, as that architecture of all of these chips that are built on. So if you look at the chart here, you see that the stock is largely traded in a range between, let's say, 130 and 180 over the past year, but it recently started to break out above that 140 short-term resistance. And I think that this is on target to hit towards that 180 upward target. And if you look at the analyst a price target. It's around 175, which lines up relatively well with that upside 180 target. And I think this is really where we see the outperformance relative to the S&P 500. So you have the absolute breakout here. You have the relative strength. And this is really what gives me the confidence to see ARM continue to push back towards that 180 level. And then if you look at the fundamentals here, the company from a forward PE ratio looks expensive. It's trading at clearly almost 70 times forward earnings, which is nearly double the industry. But that's the premium that I think we have to put on, given the fact that they have 100% monopoly on the architecture of custom inference chips, which is where the entire market is going in. And it's very clear that right now, even with the sheer amount of capital expenditure that's being pushed towards AI compute right now, it is not enough to meet the customer demand at the moment. And that's why these companies are spending hundreds of billions of dollars each year to try to gain that the compute in order to satisfy what is the expected demand over the next few years. And arguably, we're just at the very early stages of what AI compute needs for the next, call it 5 to 10 years. So the outlook, in my opinion, here for ARM looks incredibly positive, and that's why it trades at such strong premiums relative to the market.
All right, so I'm hearing another optimistic thesis that you've laid out here. Much like with Netflix, you're seeing the opportunity, at least, for a lot of potential growth here. However, your trade idea takes that bullish outlook, but takes it in a slightly different direction.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So I'm looking also here for the May 15th monthly expiration as well, but I'm looking at selling the 150 puts here, an outright put as opposed to using a put spread. Here I can collect about $7.70 earlier today, where essentially it gives me the opportunity to potentially own the stock at around $142.30 if by May expiration, the stock is below that 150 strike price. I essentially have the obligation to own the stock at that strike price minus the credit that I receive. In exchange, I'm earning $770 for the stock over the next 30 days for every contract that I sell, which translates to around 5% of the stock's value that I'm collecting in just the next 30 days. So put that into context. You know, a lot of stocks that you own might be earning somewhere in the 2-3% range from a dividend perspective, and that's on the higher end. Here, you're earning 5% in income in just 30 days. So that's really what makes this put looks so attractive here in the current market environment, where even if it trades sideways, I would be collecting that credit. If it does weaken a little bit here over the next month or so, it gives me the opportunity to buy the stock at that 140 level, which is just around where it broke out from that recent resistance level, which would be, from my perspective, a great level to earn this to own the stock at from a risk reward perspective.
So this trade idea, Tony, actually reminded me of a question that came in from a viewer named David that I wonder if you could weigh in on. He's asking generally about trades like this one. He wants to know what the pros and cons are of selling cash secured puts for income. How would you answer that?
Yeah, it's a really fantastic question. You know, from my perspective, a cash secured put is a stock acquisition strategy. You can in some ways make a comparison of a cash secured put to placing a limit order, because when you sell a 150 put, you're essentially obligating yourself to buy the stock at $150. But the difference between a limit order and a cash secured put is that a limit order doesn't pay you anything. There are obviously other differences between it, but a cash secured put in this particular case pays me 5% of the stock's value over the next 30 days. So that if the stock is below 150 by that May expiration, I now own the stock with a 5% discount compared to placing a limit order. Now, you obviously have to sell a cash secured put for at least 100 shares, and that's one of the parts that may be a downside for some investors, especially if you have a smaller account, because you need, in this particular case, roughly $14,230 per contract contract in order to sell one put or one cash secured put on this particular stock. And that may be outside of the range of certain account sizes. So this is a trade that is only suitable for if you can afford to buy 100 shares of the stock. But if that is the case, you are collecting a sizable percentage of the stock's premium of the stock's price over the next 30 days to potentially acquire the stock at a pretty significant discount.
But the first thing you said, Tony, I think makes the most sense to me. It sounds like a potential acquisition strategy. So you can potentially use a cash secured put for income as long as you're constantly reminding yourself that you might have the obligation to buy the stock.
That's exactly right.
Great. All right. So before we go, I did want to, of course, take a look at your look back trade this week, which you're doing something a little unique here. So I'm interested to see how it plays out. Your look back trade is actually based on the first trade idea from today. And I'm unclear personally whether I should be thinking of it as a roll or is it two distinct trades?
Yeah, so so you should think of it as a roll, but it also is ultimately two distinct trades, right? So about a month ago, I laid out a bullish thesis here on Netflix, and that was when the stock was trading around $93. We looked at selling the 93.86 put vertical. At the time, we sold that for about $2.55. Now, right before earnings announcement later this afternoon, that credit spread that we sold for $2.55 is now worth only 22 cents, which means that we've made roughly 90% of the maximum profit potential on this credit spread. And from my perspective, when you've made 90% of the profit potential on a credit spread heading into a catalyst event like earnings to this afternoon, you're better off closing this particular trade because in the best case scenario, you only have another 10% left to be made. In the worst case scenario, you could lose up to 90%. So the risk reward does not favor you to continue to hold on to this credit spread that we have had from about a month ago. What's I recommend for users at the moment is to close out this particular trade at a profit and then look at potentially opening up the new trade that we just laid out here in the first part of the show of selling that May 15th put spread to roll that to the new put spread here for Netflix. This way you've recentered the strikes, you've essentially taken profits on the first trade, rolled it into the second trade, and now you're recentering this particular trade for the current earnings announcement this afternoon.
Just curious, Tony, if you think that's a real psychological barrier for a lot of people to get to the place where they can close out a trade early. Is that something that you see?
Absolutely, especially I think psychologically a lot of people struggle with closing a losing trade when they should. We tend to hold on to losers longer than we should. On the flip side, we tend to see people will take profits quicker than they really should. So that's really some of the things that I think a lot of traders struggle with psychologically speaking is how do you balance the profitability factor, which if you think about it, the most optimal thing to do is cut your losers when you should and then hold on to your winners as long as you possibly can. But as human beings, many times we struggle with that one aspect of trading.
Yeah, absolutely. Much easier said than done. Tony, thank you again for taking time to share your trade thoughts and your insights today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Jim. Really pleasure to be here.
And for everybody watching, thank you, of course, for taking time out of your day to be with us as well. Just a quick reminder not to forget to tune in to the Trading Strategy Desk follow-up session, which is tomorrow, Friday, at 1:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can sign up for that session by going to the address that you see right there, fidelity.com/inthemoneyfollowup. And if you're looking for further insights, or if you missed the live show, be sure to sign up for the Active Investor Weekly Newsletter. That's going to let you see highlights of the trades discussed, and you can do that by visiting fidelity.com/activeinvestorweekly. And one final reminder to viewers, In the Money is actually off next week, so no new episode next week, but we will be back in our usual time and place on Thursday, April 30th. Until then, be well, and we hope to see you soon.
Past performance is no guarantee of future results. Options trading entails significant risk and is not appropriate for all investors. Certain complex option strategies carry additional risk. Before trading options, contact Fidelity Investments by calling 800-544-5115 to receive a copy of characteristics and risks of standardized options. Supporting documentation for any claims, if applicable, will be furnished upon request. There are additional costs associated with option strategies that call for multiple purchases and sales of options, such as spreads, straddles, and collars, as compared with a single option trade.
Stock markets are volatile and can fluctuate significantly in response to company, industry, political, regulatory, market, or economic developments. Investing in stock involves risks, including the loss of principal.
Technical analysis focuses on market action, specifically volume and price. Technical analysis is only one approach to analyzing stocks. When considering which stocks to buy or sell, you should use the approach that you're most comfortable with. As with all of your investments, you must make your own determination as to whether an investment in any particular security or securities is right for you based on your investment objectives, risk tolerance, and financial situation. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. Greeks are mathematical calculations used to determine the effect of various factors on options. Indexes are unmanaged. It is not possible to invest directly in an index. Views expressed are as of the date indicated, based on the information available at that time, and may change based on market or other conditions. Unless otherwise noted, the opinions provided are those of Options Play, and not necessarily those of Fidelity Investments or its affiliates. Fidelity does not assume any duty to update any of the information. News, commentary, market data, and research reports are from third-party sources unaffiliated with Fidelity, unless otherwise noted, and are provided for informational purposes only. Fidelity does not endorse or adopt third-party content. Fidelity makes no guarantee that the information supplied is accurate, complete, or timely, and does not provide any warranties regarding results obtained from their use. Any screenshots, charts, or company trading symbols mentioned are provided for illustrative purposes only and should not be considered as an offer to sell, a solicitation of an offer to buy, or a recommendation for the security. Options Play and Fidelity Investments are independent entities and are not legally affiliated. The third-party trademarks appearing herein are the property of their respective owners. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. Member NYSE SIPC.
Copyright 2026, FMR LLC. All rights reserved.
Information provided in the podcast is general in nature, is provided for informational purposes only, and should not be construed as investment or tax advice. Fidelity Investments disclaims any liability for any direct or incidental loss incurred by applying any of the information in this podcast. This podcast is intended for U.S. persons only and is not a solicitation for any Fidelity product or service. This podcast is provided for your personal non-commercial use and is the copyrighted work of FMR LLC. You may not reproduce this podcast in whole or in part in any form without the permission of FMR LLC.